Tonight on The Readout.
Somebody gave me a procedure so that I wouldn't have to experience another miscarriage, the pain, the mess, the discomfort. And now we're talking about whether or not we should put that doctor in jail. This is outrageous that we would even dignify the consideration of this type of ban.
Donald Trump, this is what leaving it up to the states looks like. As Arizona's Supreme Court upholds a Civil War era near total abortion ban. State Senator Eva Birch, who you just heard, joins me in a moment. Also tonight, a New York court rejects Donald Trump's latest delay tactic as Trump's legal arguments center on him somehow being above the law. Plus, the MAGA grift. Everybody's raking in the dough, especially son-in-law Jared Kushner. But Trump's billionaire benefactors are expecting a few big favors in exchange for their campaign cash. But we begin tonight with a dark reality for the women of Arizona and a cautionary tale for every American woman, courtesy of a blast from the past. Back in 1863, 2 years into the Civil War, Arizona was not yet a U.S. state. That wouldn't happen until 1912. American women could not vote. That wouldn't happen until 1920. And the age of sexual consent for girls was just 10 years old. Yes, I said 10. That year, Arizona was declared a U.S. territory with a governor appointed by President Abraham Lincoln. His name was John Noble Goodwin. And the 27 white male legislators who wrote the rules for this brand new territory had a very specific vision, using draconian laws to bring order to what they viewed as a wild Western chaos. Among the laws they created and passed 1 year into Arizona's new status in 1864 was one stating that, quote, a person who provides, supplies, or administers to a pregnant woman or procures such woman to take any medicine, drugs, or substance, or uses or employs any instrument or other means, whatever, with intent thereby to procure the miscarriage of such woman, unless it is necessary to save her life, shall be punished by imprisonment in the state prison for not less than 2 years, nor more than 5 years. According to historian Heather Cox Richardson, the brand new legislature also provided that no black or mulatto or Indian, Mongolian or Asiatic shall be permitted to testify in court against any white person, thus making it impossible for the tiny fraction of blacks who escaped slavery by heading west to protect their property, their families or themselves from white Arizonans who might want to do them harm. This legislature also declared that all marriages between a white person and a black person shall be absolutely void. So in 1864, a legislature of 27 white men created a body of laws that discriminated against black people and people of color and made girls as young as 10 available for sex and marriage. And they mandated that any woman who became pregnant by any means must give birth. Well, today, the Arizona State Supreme Court has ruled that that 160-year-old law, almost completely banning abortion in the state, shall be enforced. Let that sink in for a moment. A 19th century law from a time when interracial marriage was illegal, but marrying a 10-year-old was perfectly legal, now dictates life in the 21st century. Women and doctors in Arizona now have 14 days, just 2 weeks, to prepare for this violent assault on reproductive rights, and they are absolutely terrified.
I'm devastated. I didn't think that they would do this. I really didn't. And, you know, it was bad enough already with a 15-week ban, because it wasn't just a 15-week ban. It was like 41 onerous restrictions on women. I mean, women have no choices now.
With good reason. This now means that if you have anything scheduled after that date, you have no access to reproductive health care. And any doctor who does try to help you will face prison time. If you had any doubt that Republicans wanted to turn back the clock, then let this day stand as a stark reminder of just what they think of women. In the 4-2 ruling, the majority of justices issued this warning to physicians across the state. Physicians are now on notice that all abortions, except those necessary to save a woman's life, are illegal, and that additional criminal and regulatory sanctions may apply to abortions performed after 15 weeks gestation. Yesterday, Donald Trump proudly reminded us that he ended Roe, lying that everyone wanted it sent back to the states.
I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and, in fact, demanded be ended, Roe v. Wade. My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state.
Well, this is exactly what happens to women when you leave it up to right-wing Christian nationalists who are waging a full-blown war on women's independence and health care in the states. Arizona joins roughly 20 states that, after the fall of Roe, now ban or seriously restrict abortion access. Women in these states are reproductive prisoners, subjugated to the will of a minority. While Trump says he wants to leave it up to the states, well, that, too, is a facade. A farce sold to the media so he can seem like he's somehow moderating his position. But behind him stand a cadre of forced birth activists who will be tasked with implementing these repressive policies across the country if he returns for a second presidency. Let me introduce you to one of them, Roger Severino, vice president of domestic policy at the Heritage Foundation. He used to work for Trump during his first administration, leading anti-abortion efforts in health and human services. This man, according to the New York Times, has been crafting a plan in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 that would circumvent and leverage the regulatory powers of federal institutions, including the Department of Health and Human Services, the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Justice, and the National Institutes of Health. Here's what Severino said when the Supreme Court ended abortion access.
The federal government has an absolute role in this. There cannot be now two Americas. One America where unborn life is protected and another where unborn life is treated as the equivalent of medical waste.
Yeah.
Right. That is untenable. This has to be settled nationally. A house divided against itself cannot stand.
Yeah.
We can't have two classes of Americans.
Quoting Lincoln. Well, it's pretty grotesque, isn't it? For this man to pimp the civil rights era and even the Lincoln legacy as an excuse to further restrict women's constitutional rights across the land, which is exactly what he intends to do. It's all laid out in a lengthy Heritage Foundation proposal that would require renaming HHS the Department of Life, ending access to mifepristone, prohibiting stem cell research, and creating a pro-life task force in the White House, among many other things. So when Donald Trump pretends that he has no negative agenda for women, know that he is lying to you. It's not what he says, but what he and the people he's going to bring with him plan to do. And he's not the only one lying to your face for political reasons. A few years ago, Carrie Lake, who lost the Arizona governor's race in 2022 and is currently running for the United States Senate, told NBC News she does not support Arizona's controversial territorial rule. But here she is just 2 years ago promoting the 1864 law.
Obviously, I think Roe v. Wade should be overturned. And I think the Supreme Court, I have a good feeling that they're going to do the right thing this time. And again, what I'll echo what Steve just said. We have a great law on the books right now. If that happens, we will be a state where we will not be taking the lives of our unborn anymore.
There is a reason that Trump and Lake and other Republicans are doing this. And that is because the vast majority of Americans, 70%, support abortion access in all or most cases. That is why today's decision is not just a catastrophe for women, but also a political earthquake. And just like the state of Florida, Arizona voters could very well have a chance to restore women's rights. Just last week, a coalition of reproductive rights organizations announced that they have gathered more than 506,000 petition signatures to get an abortion access measure on the ballot this fall. That is if Republicans allow them to get that far under his eye. Joining me now is Arizona State Senator Eva Birch, who has bravely discussed her own recent abortion, and Melissa Murray, professor of law at NYU and MSNBC legal analyst. State Senator Birch, I'm just going to let you talk about the reaction of yourself, who's been through this ordeal, and the women in your state to this ruling.
To be honest with you, I am shook. I mean, I'm just dumbfounded. I don't think that we were really expecting this. I cannot believe that we are even having this conversation, to be honest with you. And I've been watching some of my Republican colleagues and just the Republican legislators here in Arizona starting to backpedal. But what we have to look at is the reality that this ban could have been repealed at any moment. This ban didn't, we didn't have to have this conversation at all. Arizona legislators had the authority to repeal this ban at any time. And not only did they not do it, but they filed an amicus brief bragging about how they didn't do it. So we are in a situation now where we have to be really cautious about making sure that the people of Arizona and of this country understand why we're here and what needs to be done next.
Let me come to you, Melissa. Let me put the map back up here of the states where abortion is now banned or on the way to being banned. This person from the Heritage Foundation or Heritage Action said from Project 2025, essentially quoted Lincoln, you know, who said America cannot survive half slave and half free. It's very clear that the right wants the country to be all slave.
Well, again, Roger Severino, who you mentioned, is not unknown in this conservative legal movement. His wife is Carrie Severino. She was at one time the head of the Judicial Crisis Network. That's part of Leonard Leo's shadowy network of organizations that has completely reshaped the federal judiciary and has also helped change the face of judiciaries at the state level. And, you know, the senator noted that they weren't expecting this. They should have been expecting this because the Republican government in Arizona stocked that state Supreme Court with Republican appointees. It's an entirely Republican court. Of course, this was going to be the outcome. Like, I testified against Brett Kavanaugh when he was nominated to the United States Supreme Court, and I said that he would be a reliable vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. I was laughed at, but I was right. We cannot continue to be surprised. They are playing in our faces. We know what they're going to do. We need to act now. This map looks horrible. It's not just Arizona that's reintroducing this new slash old law from 1864. Mm-hmm. There's an 1849 law that is going to be used in Wisconsin unless a court steps in and stops it. Michigan repealed its law. This is happening all over the country. It is go time.
Yeah, President Biden treating Trump did this. But Trump did it to the to Melissa's point, Senator Birch, openly. I mean, every single member that he put on the Supreme Court lied in their hearings, but it was a lie that was easy to catch. It was very clear that the six people who were going to who overturned Roe were going to do it. And Republicans, I mean, I'm wondering if Republican voters in your state are ever going to catch up to the fact that every single Republican is going to vote to do it. You give the United States Senate to Republicans. They're going to do it on a national level. You've got your Attorney General, Chris May, saying they won't prosecute doctors under this decision. Well, good luck with that, because all you have to do is get the wrong governor in there like we had in Florida, where he'll just fire any prosecutor that won't do it. At this point, are people being naive in relying on somehow something is going to stop this progression of the Handmaid's Tale when the truth is only not having Republicans in charge of things will stop it?
That is absolutely the case. And what an excellent and important point to make, that we have to start believing these people when they tell us what they're going to do to us, because consistently that's what's been happening. And we just tried to bring a bill to the Senate floor just to protect access to birth control, and they wouldn't even hear it. We had a bill on the House side that would have repealed this ban, and they wouldn't even hear it. So when they are telling us that we're not even going to talk about protecting birth control, we should believe that that's what they're coming for next. We have to understand that this is a ball that's going to continue rolling, and that there is one way out. And the one way out is to stop electing these really extremist Republicans who end up being the ones who are calling the shots and who are in charge. And they are not representative of the majority of Arizonans, including independents and Republicans. But that is going to continue to happen if we don't make changes in November.
Let me note that Clint Bowlick and Catherine Hackett King are two of the state justices who voted to make all abortion illegal under the rules that exist when you could marry and breed up a 10-year-old, and when interracial marriage was made illegal, and when black and brown people couldn't testify against a white person. That's the era. When people say they want to make America great again, I don't understand how people don't know that that's the era they mean. They mean the 19th century, when women were cattle and black people were cattle. And this law is very specifically directed. Voters like yourself, state senator, white women voters tend to vote majority Republican. You think they're going to do that again in November?
I am really hoping that this is a stark wake-up call. I absolutely think that having the ballot initiative on the ballot in Arizona in November is going to make a difference. I do think that it's a call to voters. We are going to need people who traditionally have not been engaged in the political process and who stay home to care. We need them to be politically engaged. We need them to come to the ballot in November. Do I think that people who have been rooted in these super far-right talking points are going to change their minds? Absolutely not. I think it's going to be up to the rest of us, but the rest of us are the majority. And really, these individuals and these extremists who are passing these laws and who are pushing these agendas do not represent the majority of the people in Arizona. And so we really just need the engagement. We need people to show up.
Melissa, let's talk about the end game here, because one of the things that they're doing in the state of Arizona is attempting to make it harder for ballot initiatives to even be placed on the ballot in this state and other states, to try to make it harder to undo it. So the Handmaid's Tale, when you watch it, what's amazing is how mundane the lead up to it was. Yeah. They simply passed laws to make it harder to stop the small minority of religious extremists from doing what they want. You have six members of the Supreme Court who say, no, woman, you don't have that right. They've also signaled they're coming for birth control. Yeah. They want that to be illegal. They think that's an abortifacient. They think IUDs are human pesticide and abortifacient. I'm not sure what else they have to do for Americans to understand the end game is the Handmaid's Tale.
No, we are surely slouching towards Gilead at this point. They're being very clear. The Supreme Court in 2022 in Dobbs said that they were simply doing a democracy move. Like, they were shifting this back to the states to let the people decide. But when the people decide, and it's just like the senator said, even individuals who express pro-life interests repel at the prospect of the state having this much control about going back to 1864. So they want some moderation here, and this is not available in a decision like this one. Authoritarians are going to authoritarian, and that's what we're getting here. And so, yes, they are seeing what the voters want. The voters are acting through ballot initiatives and referenda. And it's really important to understand, when the voters can directly register their preferences, they overwhelmingly favor reproductive rights. It's only when their votes are mediated through gerrymandered state legislatures that we get these draconian rules. And that's what these Republicans are afraid of. That's why they are limiting the use of voter referenda and ballot initiatives in Mississippi. They brought back the ballot initiative, but they said that you couldn't use it for quote unquote constitutional rights. They are changing the game, moving the football like authoritarians do.
Two credibly accused sex pests on the Supreme Court decide that you don't have rights over your own body. States are passing laws to make it harder for women to get access to things like education and grants and business grants, trying to drive women back into the kitchen, and then saying you also can't control your own reproduction. Women, wake up. When a war is being waged upon you, you are at war whether you want to be at or not. And the Republican Party has openly declared war on women. Wake up. State Senator Eva Birch, Melissa Murray, thank you both very much. Up next, Trump has managed to avoid consequences for most of his actions. Another guy sexually accused sex pest. But he can't seem to delay next week's criminal hush money trial, which is also an election interference trial. Stay right there. We are now less than 1 week from the first ever criminal trial of a former United States president getting underway. And Donald Trump has been scrambling to try any maneuver he can to keep that from happening. And to do that, Trump is essentially arguing that there should be a two-tier justice system, placing him above the law with extra rights that no other American has. But for the second time in less than 24 hours, a New York appeals court judge has denied Trump's last-minute bid to delay that trial. Today's rejection comes as Trump's lawyers were calling for an indefinite postponement while Trump fights the partial gag order imposed by Judge Juan Marchan, which followed yesterday's rejection by another appeals court judge over Trump's attempts to postpone the trial for a change of venue request, claiming that he cannot possibly get a fair trial in Manhattan. Meanwhile, we are just over 2 weeks away from the Supreme Court oral arguments over Trump's claim of absolute presidential immunity in the federal election interference case, which Trump is hoping will not only provide him a get out of jail free card in that trial, but also perhaps apply to his others as well. In a 66-page filing, special counsel Jack Smith argues to the court that counter to Trump's claims, he is not above the law. Quote, The president's constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed does not entail a general right to violate them. The framers never endorsed criminal immunity for a former president. And all presidents from the founding to the modern era have known that after leaving office, they faced potential criminal liability for official acts. Join me now is Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney, professor at the University of Alabama Law School and MSNBC legal analyst, and former Congressman Denver Riggleman, who served as a senior advisor to the January 6th Select Committee. Joyce Vance, assess the strength of Jack Smith's filing for us.
So Jack Smith's filing, I think, is technically very strong. He's covered all the bases. His main argument is, look, Trump's not entitled to immunity. But then he tells the court, if you find that perhaps there's some small area where presidents do get immunity, it's not this case. This is a case about trying to steal an election. You don't need to go any further looking at where there might be exceptions because this case is not it.
Denver Riggleman, you were on the investigative team looking at what happened on January 6th. What official acts did you find in that investigation that Trump was engaged in on January 6th?
And that's what was so tough about it. It's great to be here, by the way, is that, you know, there was always one or two layers, you know, between the White House and what was going on the ground. However, we did find direct contact on text messages between the Oath Keepers and Donald Trump's, actually the people who work for Donald Trump. We also found phone numbers that were going back and forth with the planners, and also one that was very questionable that came from the White House switchboard or through the switchboard to somebody on the ground. So what's interesting to me is that we might be able to go further with the 35 million plus lines of data that we have, but that direct line has always been difficult based on the fact he had so many people surrounding him that were doing such nefarious things. And, you know, gosh, you know, I wish that we had a little bit longer, you know, to look at the data. But, you know, at some point we have to wonder what was going on in the White House at that time and what were those phone calls? What would they actually consist of?
But let me add, but to drill down just a little bit further, because I'm asking about official acts. Can you think of, just as a former member of Congress and as somebody who investigated what happened on January 6th, can you think of an official, presidential official reason why a president or his chief of staff would be talking to the Oath Keepers?
No, there is no reason to do that. You know, especially the people that they were talking to. You know, when I wrote the book, The Breach, we talked about, we had this bizarre scene where an Oath Keeper was trying to actually contact the White House by actually texting the White House switchboard, which is a landline. We found out later that that individual was actually trying to text Andrew Giuliani. It was Kellyanne Sorrell, you know, for the Oath Keepers, and she actually admitted to it. And that's why, you know, when the American people look at this, why in the world would there be anybody who was on the ground on January 6th, whether they're Oath Keepers or Proud Boys or anybody like that, actually be in direct contact with White House staff? To me, it's absolutely mind-boggling, and I think it's something that's been underreported.
And Joyce, to go back to the constitutional question, Donald Trump is trying to get immunity by saying that what he was doing on January 6th was part of his official role as president. How can attempting to personally remain in office beyond an election that you lost be an official act as president?
Right. So, I mean, I think we all know the answer to that question. The president was acting in a personal capacity when he did this. And this is what Jack Smith argues in his brief. He says there's plenty of personal conduct here that would substantiate a trial purely on that conduct alone. That doesn't mean, though, that the government would be barred from using evidence of official acts. In other words, they would be able to bring in all the conversations that you've been talking about with the congressman, Trump's efforts to abuse the power of the presidency to further his conspiracies. That would all be fair game, even if the conspiracy itself was limited to Trump's engagement with personal actors in a purely personal capacity trying to hold on to power.
Yeah, this is what Jack Smith writes in his filing. President's alleged criminal scheme to overturn an election and thwart the peaceful transfer of power to his lawfully elected successor is the paradigmatic example of conduct that should not be immunized, even if other conduct should be. And Denver, I'll just ask you this follow-up. If, in fact, the Supreme Court, six, the ones that are friendly to Trump, somehow find that that Trump is immunized from any sort of legal consequence for that kind of behavior, what do you think the consequences would be?
Oh, my goodness. You're talking about, if, you know, for me, you know, actually, I want to say Ms. Vance makes an incredible point, is that Jack Smith can go a lot further than the committee could based on the type of data that they can get, right? They can get actually geolocation data. They can get phone record data that we weren't allowed to get based on our authorities as congressional investigators and oversight. So The flip side of that is, if the law isn't equally applied to people like that, if Jack Smith finds that evidence, that direct linkage, which, you know, was so damn close anyway when we were doing this on the January 6th committee, it would be absolutely, I think, mind-boggling, and maybe that cascading effect of people not having any faith in the justice system at this point. And I think at that point, you're going to see a lot of people that are angry, and I would suspect maybe some protests, you know, if, listen, if law is not equally applied, what do we do at that point?
Very good point. Let me go really quickly, Joyce Vance, before we let you go here. Aileen Cannon seems to be really trying to protect herself from getting this case taken taken from her by the 11th Circuit. She's ruled for Jack Smith his request to redact the names of some 24 government witnesses that Trump wanted to reveal in public versions of one of his big filings in the classified docs case. It seems to be a very big deal, but it also seems to be self-protective on her part.
You know, every time we find an issue where Judge Cannon rules for Jack Smith, I feel like putting it in air quotes.
Yeah.
Because here, even though she rules for him, she does it after really criticizing him for behavior that's just not objectionable by a prosecutor. She seems to have the view that he was dilatory in filing and did it in an irresponsible fashion. The reality is that Smith will still have to justify all of these redactions of the names of witnesses from public view. Look, every judge has an obligation to protect the integrity of their courtroom, to protect witnesses and jurors who are engaging in public service when they participate in the criminal justice system. It's just unthinkable that a judge would not be very careful with the safety and security of those people. And yet this judge almost seems to resent having to protect them simply because it's the special prosecutor that's asking for that.
Well, the better to audition for the Supreme Court if Trump becomes president again. I said that, not you, Joyce Vance, and I'll take responsibility for it. Denver Riggleman, thank you both very much. Up next on The Readout, grifters gonna grift, and Trump's campaign egged on by billionaires too cheap to pay their fair share of taxes is the ultimate grift. The Readout continues after this. Whether it be the gold sneakers, the trading card NFTs, or the God Bless the USA Bibles, by now we all know that everything Donald Trump touches turns into a grift. Well, today we can add Truth Social to that list as shares of Trump Media stock have officially erased all of the gains made since they began trading last month, proving the social media site to be little more than a pump and dump scam. There's also Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. The New York Times is reporting today that his $3 billion investment fund is financed almost entirely by overseas investment funds from countries he worked with when he was a senior advisor in the Trump White House, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Now, we don't know what these countries expect from little old Jared in return for their investments, nor do we know why donors keep giving Donald Trump money when it's clear that he's going to burn it all on his legal fees, not for his campaign. Well, for the uber rich, the answer is simple. Tax cuts. That's the only policy that matters to many of them. It beats out the embrace of authoritarianism or stripping half of the nation's population of their rights over their own bodies, or saying that migrants are poisoning the blood of the country, or, you know, the whole attempted coup thing. As long as their taxes stay low and get lower, they're good. Take billionaire and Republican mega donor Nelson Peltz, for example. The Washington Post reports that the day after January 6th, Peltz called the insurrection a disgrace and expressed remorse for voting for Trump, saying, quote, "I'm sorry I did that." Well, he's obviously not that sorry, as last month he had breakfast with Trump and other billionaires and then told the Financial Times that he would probably vote for the twice impeached, four times indicted, liable for sexual abuse former president again this fall. And he's not the only one. The Post goes on to say that elite donors who once balked at Trump's fueling of the Capitol insurrection, worried about his legal problems, and decried what they saw as his chaotic presidency are rediscovering their affinity for Trump, a shift that reflects many conservative billionaires' fears of President Biden's tax agenda, which, if approved, would drastically reduce their fortunes. This was made all the more clear over the weekend as Trump held a glitzy Palm Beach fundraiser where the cost of admission for the 100 or so attendees ranged from $250,000 to $814,000 per person. And Trump vowed to this tiny audience of wealthy donors that if reelected, he will keep their taxes low, 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 low. But if you're like me, you're probably wondering, who is it exactly that's shelling out six figures to go to a Trump fundraiser? Well, we'll have more on that next.
It's going to be a very spectacular evening, and people are just wanting change. Rich people want it. Poor people want it. Everybody wants change. People, they wanted to contribute to a cause of making America great again, and that's what's happened.
Making America great again, or giving billionaires tax cuts again. That was Donald Trump on Saturday ahead of his Palm Beach fundraiser that he claims raised more than $50 million thanks to some of the nation's wealthiest political donors. Join me now is NBC News senior national politics reporter Jonathan Allen. All right, Jonathan, which rich poobahs were in the room?
Hi, Joy. It was actually under a big tent, I'm told, by a Trump campaign official. 117 seated guests at this event at the home of John Paulson. So there's one of those big name billionaires we're talking about.
And tell me who he is. Tell me who John Paulson is.
So he's one of these private equity hedge fund guys. Made a ton of money. Basically, if you remember The Big Short, the book or the movie, he basically bet against the housing market and bet very well. He was already wealthy before that, obviously, in order to do that. There are other families there, other billionaires. The Pepe Fanjul, whose family is Florida Crystals, basically the big sugar industry in Florida, was there. Woody Johnson, the co-owner of the New York Jets, who earned his money the old-fashioned way by having it come down from his family, Johnson & Johnson. And then Harold Hamm, the big oil baron, was also among the guests there.
And what do these poobahs, these American oligarchs, expect to get from King Trump?
I mean, there is a huge difference in the Biden policy and the Trump policy. Biden has promised that he's going to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans. And what Donald Trump said to these donors, according to one of his campaign officials, was that he was going to keep their taxes low. He's going to try to extend the Trump tax cuts for 2017. That would cost the Treasury hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars over a decade, which, of course, would be put back on the American people in the form of debt. Biden has said he's going to raise taxes on these folks, and obviously they would prefer not to give him their money to raise their taxes.
Donald Trump has done a new thing where people who raise $2.5 million for him, for his legal defense fund, get to get a personalized pair of his gold Never Surrender high-top sneakers, according to a donor access program menu shared with NBC News. So basically, the $300 sneakers will cost you just $2.5 million in fundraising. How many takers are there for those?
Don't have an exact number yet, Joy, but there certainly will be some. I think somebody much smarter and more interesting than myself once said, it's got to be the shoes. That's, I guess, what gets you to give $2.5 million. They did not say how they would be personalized. Many times things are signed. I don't know if this means Donald Trump's going to wear them around for a while, but the shoes are the big thing that those donor access menu talks about. They also get access to Trump campaign officials and various updates and retreats. And
maybe
like
a nicer spot in the gulag if they criticize Trump and he gets angry. Let me ask you. You do a lot of reporting on Donald Trump, his promises and his campaign. What is he promising the ordinary MAGA who is willing to go to jail for him, in some cases commit felonies for him, the people who are out there at his rallies? What do they get? Because the super rich get super big tax cuts. He won't have an incentive to do another stimmy because he won't be facing another election. He'll be in for life. So there's not another reelection. So there's no reason to give them another check, another stimmy check. So what do they get?
Yeah, I mean, you're pointing out a very huge conflict in his campaign's sort of theory or who it's marketing to here, obviously, raising all this money from billionaires who want their taxes cut and also presenting himself as this populist. What do they get? He's arguing that they're going to get a better economy, that their boats will be lifted by a freer economy.
You mean a better economy than the one now with 3.8% unemployment and people getting their $30,000 student loan debt wiped out? Better than that with the stock market in record high and us drilling more oil than any country in human history? Better than that economy? How's he going to do that? He didn't do it the first time. I'm just being honest. The economy was worse when he was there. What's his plan for that?
I'm not making the case that he's right, simply telling you what he's telling folks.
Yeah.
But that's essentially what his argument is to the bottom of the scale. And the folks, in terms of the folks who charge the capital, he's teasing the possibility of pardons for people he refers to as patriots.
Yeah. And those would be the most violent criminals that are currently locked up for assaulting police officers and committing mayhem, not just the ones who took a poop in the Capitol. Those people are already home. Jonathan Allen, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming up next. An RFK Jr. advisor said the quiet part out loud, admitting that her number one priority is to defeat President Biden, which means another Trump presidency. We'll be right back. Another day, another said the quiet part out loud thing that Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s independent presidential campaign is distancing itself from. You'll remember last week it was a fundraising email calling January 6th defendants activists. And this time it's a pretty shocking admission from a New York campaign staffer, Rita Palma, about the campaign's real goal.
The Kennedy voter and the Trump voter, the enemy, our mutual enemy is Biden. Whether you support Bobby or Trump, we all oppose Biden. 270 wins the election. If you don't get to 270, if nobody gets to 270, then Congress picks the president, right? Right now, we have a majority of Republicans in Congress. So who are they going to pick? Who are they going to pick if it's a Republican Congress? They'll pick Trump.
Those edited comments are part of a presentation to Republican voters since deleted from YouTube. NBC News obtained the fuller video from a source who downloaded it, and Palma hasn't responded to NBC's request for comment. She's a longtime anti-vaccination activist in New York State. In 2020, the New York Post reported on Palma as the founder of an anti-vaccine group, My Kids, My Choice. She said, quote, COVID is God's gift to the vaccine choice movement. It's woken up so many people and put us in a national spotlight, unquote. So naturally, it makes sense. She's an RFK fan. In the video, she identifies herself as the campaign's New York State director. But according to Kennedy's campaign, Rita Palma is a ballot access consultant responsible for scheduling volunteer shifts for our upcoming signature collection drive in the Empire State, adding that she is not involved in electoral strategy nationally or in New York. This was not a campaign event. Palma was speaking as a private citizen, and her statements in no way reflect the strategy of the Kennedy campaign. Joining me now is freelance investigative journalist Jacqueline Sweet. Jacqueline, thank you for being here. Ms. Palma, what is her connection to the campaign?
She's known Robert Kennedy for a long time. She was actually made vice president of his children's health defense nonprofit, which, as many know, believes that all vaccines are risky.
And meaning not just COVID vaccines.
Childhood vaccines.
Yeah, meaning MMR, meaning measles vaccines, all of it.
Right. So she's been an activist in local and then state level politics. She was advocating for loosening the restrictions on religious exemptions for vaccinations in school. And in 2019, New York State did away with religious exemptions. So that's been her focus of her lobbying for years.
So she wants kids with measles to go to school with kids who don't have measles.
She wants children who are not vaccinated to be able to go to school. And she previously wanted the schools to not even investigate the religious exemption.
And she shares that with RFK Jr., right? I mean, well, let me just play RFK Jr. Because when she said, what she sounded like she was saying is that the magic of their campaign is that it would help Trump get in. Here's what RFK Jr. said last week on CNN.
I can make the argument that President Biden is a much worse threat to democracy. And the reason for that is President Biden is the first candidate in history, the first president in history that has used the federal agencies to censor political speech, so to censor his opponent. I can say that because I just won a case in the Federal Court of Appeals and now before the Supreme Court. It shows that he started censoring not just me. 37 hours after he took the oath of office, he was censoring me. No president in the country has ever done that. The greatest threat to democracy is not somebody who questions election returns.
Now, we know that what he was angry about being censored about was his anti-vax statements. So as you look at this campaign, does it appear to be a campaign designed not so much to make RFK Jr. president, but to ensure that Biden is not president because RFK Jr. is angry that he's not allowed to parrot anti-vax statements on the private Twitter and Facebook?
It's interesting because the campaign has since walked back Palma's role in the campaign saying, but she has been aligned with Kennedy for a long time. They've known each other, and she does have a role in the ballot push. And there's conflicting statements, but she says that she was asked, can I push this? This would help Trump at the very
minimum.
Least.
Yeah.
And she says that she asked to be able to use that. And they said, OK, so
that speaks for itself. These are the states in which RFK Jr. is on the ballot. Right now, he's on in Utah. That's 6 electoral college votes. He's got enough signatures for New Hampshire, Nevada, Hawaii, North Carolina, Idaho, and Nebraska. A couple of those, New Hampshire, Nevada, and North Carolina, are pretty important states. But the total for all of that would be 45 electoral college votes. So he does have the potential. It's not clear he could win any states, but he definitely is a threat. And the polling shows he's equally a threat to Biden and Trump. Inside RFK Jr. world, are they working toward one of two scenarios they'd prefer? Somehow RFK Jr. becomes president or Donald Trump becomes president?
It's hard to know what's in their minds, but we can look at who's materially assisting the campaign at this point, whether it's people hosting fundraisers or the people who are actually doing the on-the-ground work with getting out the signatures. And they seem to largely come from very pro-Trump factions. So if you look at sort of who's doing it as a clue, that tells us, I think, somewhat of where they're, you know,
that they prefer to have Trump be president. And is his campaign being driven almost entirely by the anti-vax movement, or is it just that and conspiracy theories? What is it?
I think there's a lot of overlap between those. But if you look at some of the top staffers, they do come from his nonprofit, and a lot of the fundraising and the fundraisers and the state level support are really coming from this anti-vax movement. But the anti-vax movement is, in a way, a conspiracy movement.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of overlap. And that goes with the anti-government kind of, this election was stolen, Palma and some of her other anti-vax people who are working on the campaign. They were staunch believers that the election was stolen in 2020.
So they have a little bit of both. Thank you very much, Jacqueline Sweet. Thank you very much for being here. And that is tonight's readout. Be careful out there, voters, because not everything is as it seems. It's important that you vote, but it's also important that you do a little vetting to know who and what you are voting for. And that's it for the readout tonight.